Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 21st, 2015. Happy birthday, buddy. Today, we're joined by our frequent guest and prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Just dandy. Just dandy. Well, it was warm today, but I was shivering a little bit because some news I heard. But before we go to that news, let's do a little physics lesson, mm-hmm. Right? The sun is a big star in the sky, and it's boiling with nuclear reactions all the time. Mm-hmm. And there's huge magnetic fields, huge electric fields. And once in a while, those electric fields collapse or blow up, and you get what's called a sunspot, right? It's mm-hmm. this big disturbance on the face of the sun. It just happens because it's sort of like a bucket of water on a stove. It's bubbling away. Turns out that for some reason that I can't tell you, but I'm not sure a real physicist could, there is an 11-year cycle to those sunspots. That they peak every 11 years or so. And of course, mm-hmm. the sunspots are what give us the aurora borealis, because the sunspots spew out all these particles, and then that gets into the Earth's atmosphere and makes light. And mm-hmm. you've heard people talk about solar storms, right, that are going to knock out all the satellites. Well, those are related to sunspots, too. So for the last several hundred years, we've been able to count sunspots every year. Scientists have been doing it, mapping this. I think it's an 11-year cycle. Mm-hmm. It's been a fundamental of solar science for a while. And, of course, people study the variation even in that cyclic variation. I mean, sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower. So with all that as precursor, DR, tell me, what bit of craziness fell out of the climatological sky this week?
Oh, well, it stems from a July 9th press release from the British Royal Astronomical Society that say that, according to a professor named Valentina Zarkova, there had been a model they had created that suggests that, quote, solar activity will fall by 60% during the 2030s to conditions last seen during the so-called mini ice age that began in 1645, unquote. And according to Andrew Seifter from Media Matters, that line was quickly distorted by climate denial outfits on both sides of the Atlantic, such as the UK Telegraph, the UK Daily Mail, and the United States Washington Times, which claims that the scientists had found that the Earth is likely heading for a mini ice age. And Andrew Seifer goes on to note, and also Eric Holthaus and Slate also go on to note, that in fact the study's author never directly suggested that a new ice age is imminent, only that we may see a sharp downturn in the number of sunspots. However, because of fairly obvious ideological reasons, namely,
as backdrop to this, I said before, there's this 11-year cycle. So if you plot the sunspots in each year, and then you plot, you know, over 200 or 300 years, you see this every 11 years there's a peak. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that in the 1760s, I guess, there was, for I think it was 20, 22, 30 years, there were essentially no sunspots. Mm-hmm. And that, at the time, the guy who was counting the sunspots year after year was a guy named Maunder. Right?
Yes.
And he was the one who said, hey, the sunspots were at this funny minimum, and it got named after him. Mr. Maunder's minimum in the sunspots. And that mm-hmm. coincided with a relatively cold cycle locally in Northern Europe.
Yes.
I guess science can somehow connect up these the solar activity to some weather patterns on Earth. And of course, that's been a rich field for the deniers to get out and talk about mm-hmm. sunspots as being the root cause of climate change.
Sure.
But that's where the Maunder minimum comes in. I mean, it's a real thing. I mean, you can go look up that correlation mm-hmm. From the 1640s, I guess it was. But you're saying is that The newspapers took it, took the football and ran with it because it made good copy.
Exactly. They ran with it. These are newspapers. The UK Daily Mail, you recall, was very instrumental in the climate gate, nonsense that was used to try to destroy the Copenhagen climate talks. The UK Daily Mail infamously tried to push the notion that climate change magically stopped in 1995. That was the talking point before 1998. And for what for our, I would suggest, are fairly obvious ideological reasons stemming from, the desire to sort of number not only weaken the impact of Laudato Si, but also to launch a preemptive strike on the Paris climate talks. Because notice how the UK Daily Mail and the UK Telegraph ran with the story so closely after the reports about China announcing its emissions targets, and the UK and the United States and Brazil basically working out a deal to say to have a mutual reduction of emissions targets. All of a sudden, these guys who don't like the idea of reducing emissions targets had to push the idea that there's no need to reduce emissions targets because, after all, there's a new ice age coming. So all of a sudden, they start promoting this bogus story. But the sad thing about the story is that news entities that usually get it right, including the website Raw Story and also CNN.com, also fell for this bogus story about a so-called oncoming new ice age, and how sad it is that news entities that should know better and do not have an ideological axe to grind fell for this sort of bogus, nonsensical story about an oncoming ice age.
Well, certainly, I think that the thing about science is that ultimately truth triumphs. So hopefully there's enough people out there saying, pointing out that this is a, well, the connection. So but the reason that this not going, of course, there would never be a global ice age caused by this, but that the impact of this solar minimum, if it comes to pass, is minor, would be because the carbon pollution that we're dumping into the atmosphere far overwhelms the impact, which is, reasonably well known, the impact of these sunspots. So if they go away and the amount of energy coming from the sun drops a tiny bit, that is minor compared to the amount that's being trapped by the greenhouse gases.
And that's the point of this story, that the deniers who are pushing this bogus meme don't want you to recognize that, even if there was a massive reduction in solar activity, reduction in sunspots, we would still need to curb carbon pollution just to avoid all the hell we're lucky to experience. I believe there was a study, that was re a story that was released on July the 16th in the Guardian, noting that, even if we cut all emissions today, the oceans would continue to heat up just because of the amount of crap we've already dumped into the oceans due to acidification. So, we've got more serious work to do, and unserious people are trying to stop us from doing it.
Well, I guess one of the I think you mentioned before one of the topics that gets got rehashed with this mini ice age thing is the old chestnut of an argument about how in the 1970s everyone was afraid of a new ice age. And in kind of in response to that, there, tell me what there was a letter from Daniel Patrick Moynihan that got posted on, I guess Joe Rome posted it on the Think Progress blog, right?
Actually, Joe Rogan made reference to it, but it was initially posted by Ari Kelman on Talking Points Memo on July the 10th. Noting that in September of 1969, President Richard Nixon's advisor and future Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote a letter to John Ehrlichman, who was then President
And these are
Nixon's.
famous names. Just, I mean, for all the people who are listening who weren't even born right before 1985, right? Ehrlichman, all right, remember Ehrlichman, and of course Richard Nixon. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was a famous sort of moderate liberal academic, right, who helped both Kennedy and Nixon, right? So he was a Democrat in the Nixon administration. Anyway, so continue.
So Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote this memo to Ehrlichman about the quote unquote carbon dioxide problem, and this was a memo that in which he basically discussed the the scientific evidence, even at that time, pointing to the risks of human-caused climate change. And Joe Rome noted that this memo was written 4 years after President Johnson, in February of 1965, it made an address to Congress in which he noted the risks of human-caused climate change. So, in the mid to late 60s, and even earlier, there was a recognition that that the major environmental risk was a warming planet, not a supposedly cooling.
Interesting. Well, so the planet is warming. We are, it's happening, right? We're trying to minimize that, but it's happening. And one of the consequences of the warming world is our impacts on water, right?
Yes,
That
yes.
there's concepts of desertification, that dry places get drier. Places like New England that are wet probably will get more precipitation, be it in the form of snow or rain. And basically, the extremes, every place takes its weather to a new extreme. So you were telling me before that there was an interesting set of TV reports on water this past week, right?
Yes, a great series by MSNBC's Chris Hayes about the severe drought in California and its connection to human-caused climate change, and interviewing a number of political figures in California about what they're doing to try to address this problem, and how there's this effort by deniers in California to try to blame it. And Chris Hayes pointing out how bogus that argument was, and Hayes also noted the severe economic impact of this drought, and the sort of impact it's having on agriculture, and the role that agriculture played in causing this drought in terms of the misuse of water, and sort of irresponsible farming, and sort of irresponsible use of resources, and how it sort of played a role in this sort of calamity in California. Basically, the Golden State has turned a crispy brown as a result of the drought, basically.
But I think he's basically, I would say his argument is that this is the future. We're experience. This is
Yes.
how we're going to deal with the future. These are the issues that come up, right? This is what you are presented with in a drier world, right? People
Exactly.
pulling out their almond trees and putting in, I don't know, avocado or vice versa or something. It's hot and big fights over water. I guess that
Exactly.
allows me to actually, interestingly enough, slip in something that I have been interested in for a long time. But there is, I can't even pronounce the author's name, but I'll put it in the blog. There's a book called The Water Knife, right? Which is essentially a fictional story, but set 50, 100 years in the future, out in somewhere in Arizona, and basically tries to play through in a interesting fictional way. What are the issues when you're running out of water? It's a novel about the future. I think that the author, it's an Italian name, I can't even pronounce it, I won't even try.
Yes, it's a Paolo Bacigalupi.
Right, okay, you can say it better than I. And he is also the guy who wrote something that I have actually read, is a short story called The Tamarisk Hunter, which I found just chilling. Right, very interesting, readable story. So, anyway, my point being that in addition to Chris Hayes on TV talking about, this is what the future looks like, get ready for it, there are real efforts of on an artistic perspective to try and give people ways to think about, what the impacts of stuff like severe drought will be. Right, and it's not. I haven't read this, The Water Knife, but certainly based on the other. I mean, this is not a novel that is going to be like the movie The Day After Tomorrow, where everyone freezes, right? Or there's some crazy. It's a real. I mean, The Tamarisk Hunter was just, it posed this scenario where, all the water in the Southwest was in covered channels, was all being brought down to Los Angeles, where there were still millions of people, and that the people who were left out in the desert were essentially slaves of the organization that was trying to drive the water to Los Angeles, right? What, how does that play out? It's just interesting concepts.
People should remember, you can't drink oil, but you have to drink water.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole issue of privatization of water is so profoundly, I don't know, it's not immoral, but it's like you can't live without water. It's like saying, okay, I'm going to sell you here, here's a bottle of air. You can breathe for another hour, right?
Exactly.
Please pay me money. That's just not morally correct. So the idea that, and of course, most of the world, as you well know, most of the world already does not have a reliable source of clean water, right? So just getting them the clean water in the first place is a big challenge in a world where that's going away, right?
Exactly.
Anyway, the so anyway, I advise everyone to try to take a look at the Chris Hayes reports. They're interesting, and if you read this book by, what was his name?
Bakagulubi, I believe.
There you go. Good, even though I can't pronounce his name, he's a good author, so I recommend you read him. Anyway, we got to stop there, DR. Let me tell everyone who's listening that they can check out the links to most of what we talked about at the blog. It's a WordPress blog, massclimateaction.wordpress.com. Please leave us a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook. It's slash Mass Climate Action. You can click through the Facebook link back to the blog if that's your favorite way to get to us, and listen there. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher. We come up if, again, if you search for global warming stuff. You can find us on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. If you subscribe, it helps improve our visibility, and it's a good thing. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to you all again next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.